Today, my wonderful guest is Catherine Wenger. Catherine is the water leader for Arup's business in the UK, India, the Middle East, and Africa. Her role is around ensuring excellent client relationships, a strong pipeline of impactful work, and a team well-equipped with the right skills to deliver. A value-driven leader, she's focused on ensuring that sustainability and equity lie at the heart of every project. Catherine was born in Irvine on the west coast of Scotland and comes from a long line of strong, independent women, which we'll hear more about shortly. In 1973, when Catherine was just 6 months old, her parents made the very brave and unusual decision back then to move out to Tokyo, Japan. The move normalised living abroad for Catherine and her sister, and it has had a lasting influence on Catherine's outlook on life and sparked her love of travel. Catherine was later schooled in Brussels and has since lived in London, San Francisco, and Madrid. Catherine now lives on the beautiful coast of South Wales in the seaside town of Penarth, just outside of Cardiff, with her husband and two children. Welcome to the podcast, Catherine.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Nice to see you. Thank you so much for taking part in this. So we heard in the intro, you had such an unusual upbringing, being exposed to other cultures and moving around the globe at such a young age. How has that impacted the person you are today and your work ethic?
Good question. I also often reflect on this now I have children of my own. So you're absolutely right. My first stint abroad was when I was only 6 months old. And so stories about travel and living abroad become a bit of a part of our family mythology. You know, there's always stories around the Christmas table about, do you remember when you did this and ran across the street in Tokyo and the lady was running after you yelling in Japanese? So there's lots of lovely tales about a little blonde toddler in Tokyo. And I think that whole telling the stories and building it into the family mythology and having other members of the family living abroad as well. So my uncle Bobby also lived in Japan at the same time. And he used to talk about all you needed in life was a toothbrush, a passport and a bit of money and you could go anywhere. So again, that was one of those phrases that I remembered. And I think that my career choice was probably partly influenced by the desire to be able to keep traveling. I lived abroad as a child in Brussels as well, and I knew that I wanted to keep doing that. So by picking engineering, I reckoned that gravity was the same the world over and that I'd probably be able to find a job anywhere if I became an engineer. So there was definitely that influencing where I went with my career choices.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it must have been really unusual back in the 70s to be moving abroad to Japan, and I imagine it was completely different to how it is now.
Yes, there's wonderful tales about my 6'4" father standing on the Tokyo tube and looking right over the top of every single person on the train. And my blonde sister being born in a hospital and being swaddled and wheeled around in a trolley as the only blonde and amongst a whole trolley full of dark-haired Japanese babies. So yes, very, very unusual. And that feeling of being different in a place has probably equipped me, without realizing it, very well for walking into meetings and things where I'm the only woman in the meeting and just getting on with it, because I've been to lots of different schools, I've met lots of different people, and you have to just launch yourself in with confidence and belief that somebody in there is going to want to talk with you and become your friend.
Yeah, great. So you mentioned your sister there. So your sister was actually born in Tokyo, is that right?
Yeah, she was born whilst we were there, yes.
Yeah, so, and I think, am I right in saying there's a bit of an interesting story around her birth? And so I guess yeah, tell us a bit more about that and your mum and this sort of lineage of strong women that you come from.
Yeah, so there's a lovely tale about my mum going into labour in Tokyo, in a city where she doesn't speak the language. And my father's at work, of course, because that's what you did then, and this was 76. And she first off went shopping and checked that there was going to be enough groceries. And only then did she call herself a cab. And only then did she tell my father that she was going into hospital to have their second child. So there's just this phenomenal focus in getting the right things done. And only then going into hospital. Yes, it's So my mum is very, very strong character and very self-sufficient, shall we say. Whenever we've lived abroad, she's been the one who has found us somewhere to live, who has coped with the local bureaucracy, registered us for dentists and doctors, and basically made it work. She was very clear that although she didn't have an official job, her job was to enable that level of family travel and the ease and joy that we got from living overseas.
Lovely. And I think your grandmothers sort of went against the grain of what it was like to be a woman in their time as well.
Yes. So I was fortunate enough actually to know both my grandmothers very well and one of my great grandmothers. And all three of them had worked at times when it was quite unusual to work. So my great grandmother was a tram driver during the First World War. My grandmother joined the Land Army and went to university to study agriculture, and my other grandmother was an anaesthetist, so she was a doctor. So all three of them worked, and I have very strong memories as a child visiting one of my grandmothers and her in the morning putting on the slow cooker. She was a slow cooker fan, getting dinner ready, chopping onions whilst the rest of us were trying to eat breakfast, chopping onions and getting the slow cooker on, picking up her briefcase and going off to work, even whilst I was a child. So that impression of women working and being very active, and even once they had retired, that drive didn't stop. You know, one of my grandmothers did an open university course, studied English literature to degree level in her 70s and 80s because she was interested and just wanted to keep learning. So that was just normalized that whole active, outward facing, go getting, busy women just was what I saw around me.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it? Because I'm guessing you grew up just seeing women doing everything that men were doing. And so have you ever been particularly conscious of your gender?
No, I wasn't until actually quite far into my career, strangely. You know, I would register that I might be the only woman in a room full of engineers and contractors. But because one of my schools had been a boys' boarding school with only a few girls in the sixth form, I was quite used to that. I'd done physics and math, so I was always outnumbered. It just was. That's just the way it was. So I just sort of got on with it. And in the start of my professional career, I just got on with it. And I never viewed it consciously as an issue. And it was only when I started hearing stories from other women who were struggling and who were having challenges that I started to look around and perhaps pick up on a few of the things that were going on. And I often describe this as when I became a bit of a reluctant role model. I realized that I was now in quite a senior female. And these other women were looking to me for help, for guidance, for inspiration. And some of the things they were having to deal with were really quite shocking. And it was a bit of a wake-up call, because I thought, well, now I'm in a position, I can help them, I can amplify their voice, I can rattle the bars, I can make, you know, assist them, and I can bring some of their concerns to life. And that was a real change. And that was when I moved from being a reluctant role model to actually a willing participant in the equity, diversity and inclusion discussions.
Yeah. Is there anyone particularly during your career or in life generally that you've kind of looked up to, or perhaps they've inspired you along the way?
Yeah, so I've got a couple of ideas here. So one was a client, I'll give him a shout out, Ian Titherington. I'm not sure if he'll ever hear this, but a great guy working for Cardiff Council. And the reason he inspired me is he had a vision for a project called Greener Grangetown, which was to really help regenerate an area of Cardiff that had high levels of deprivation through water and through using water as a catalyst to create green spaces to create desirable neighbourhoods, ownership, and also help with improving the water quality in the local river. So great aspirations. And this project would not have even happened without his persistence and patience. It took 12 years for it to come to fruition. It's only a small scheme, and he just kept going because he believed in it. And that utter belief and conviction about doing the right thing, I found very, very inspiring. And the second person I was going to mention is a lady I met early in my career with Arup. She still works with us. Her name's Devla Mitchell. And she's held various very senior roles. And I remember one conversation with her when we were talking about women and how women's networks can be supportive. She mentioned that she said, you know, sometimes being a woman will count against you, but then sometimes it'll actually offer you opportunities. And when it does, you should grab them. And I'm smiling now as I'm reflecting that I've received an invitation to speak at a conference recently where they wanted a more diverse panel. And part of me is going, oh, really? Is that the reason you want me to come speak? And the other part of me is remembering what she said and thinking, okay, they want me to come speak. I wish it wasn't because I was female, but I'm going to make damn sure I make the most of that opportunity and make my presence felt. And the next time they invite me will be because they know I've got something brilliant to say and I happen to be female.
Thank you. You mentioned working with Ian Tetherington on the Greener Grangetown project then. It just sounds really, really interesting. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so for those of you who know Cardiff, or those of you who don't, there's an area called Grangetown near the big stadium where you might see the large rugby matches. And it's a very, very diverse neighbourhood, but it has had high levels of deprivation for years, but it's right next to the river. And it has some wide streets which were filled with parked cars. And Ian had this, he worked for the council, and he noticed that it's a very simple thing, but all the downpipes from the fronts of the buildings go into what's called a combined sewer. And you'll have heard all about these in the news at the moment. So all the rainwater was going into the sewers and was then being pumped 8 miles away to be treated. And it seemed such a waste that we were doing that, wasting energy and money in moving rainwater. And instead, he wanted to separate out that rainwater, put it through a series of rain gardens to be cleaned and treated before it was then discharged into the river. And the lovely thing here is that by introducing rain gardens into the streets, you're bringing in biodiversity, you're bringing in traffic calming because you can build them on the sides of roads and help slow down traffic. We changed all the paving around so it was really great for cyclists. We made it very pedestrian accessible. We did green routes to schools. So loads of wonderful additional benefits. So a real community grounded scheme. And it needed a lot of buy-in from different people. So it was a real partnership project as well. And that was tough. And at first, the partners weren't all on board. So we had to do a lot of persuading. So I was lucky enough to be leading the engineering team, and Ian was the client. And we worked with Natural Resources Wales, with Welsh Water, with local community groups and schools and mosques, and set up stands on the green to tell people about it. So it was a really grassroots project. And now I get to cycle and walk through it regularly and see what a lovely place it now is and what a difference it's made to the area. It's also been a bit of a pilot in that it has inspired other projects. So we've now got a Greener Whitchurch happening, and there are folks come to visit from all over the country and overseas to come and see this area, see what you can do by separating out your water and using water as a catalyst for great things in the community. So it's a really inspirational project, and probably one of my favourite projects, but it's tiny, you know, it's only a few streets long.
I've been there, and I wasn't aware of the project and why the area had changed. So I just found it really interesting speaking to you about it. And it really is, it's a lovely area now. And I feel like you described it to begin with as, you know, full of parked cars, and people just parked there and commuted to wherever they were going on the train, as well as the people that lived there. And it was just one of those, yeah, it was one of those areas that just needed a little bit of love. And I think now you can see that people have come out onto the streets a little bit more. There's a lot more pedestrianised, as you've said. Yeah. So there's sort of less cars, more people, a lot more of like community involvement, and it just looks prettier, which I think then makes people proud to live there and feel that they've been invested in, I suppose, and they've had a bit of love really from the Welsh Government and Cardiff Council.
Yeah, it's one of those ones where everybody loves to point at it and say, well, oh, you know, that they were part of it and they're very proud of it. And we even got to have Cardiff Uni came along and helped us with water quality monitoring and sentiment analysis. So it got a great bit of traction. It was one of those tiny schemes that hits much harder than the size of the scheme in terms of how it's inspired people. So yeah, big pride, big proud moment, that one.
Nice. And I know that's really important to you, isn't it? And you're the project leader on the Arup Global Challenge project. And we've talked, when we first met, we talked about the kind of six capitals way of thinking. I just wondered whether you can tell us a little bit more about that, because it's really, really interesting.
Yeah, so I'll take the two separately. So the Global Challenge is something that we did, or we're still doing, where Arup has the advantage, we're an employee-owned organisation, so we get to choose what we do with our money and our income. And one of the things we actually have in our founding principles is support to charities. So we were looking at the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals and how we could help upskill charities to deliver against those. So rather than just donating money, how we could use our expertise and our knowledge to help embed change. And so one of those was working with a charity called Frank Water, who's based in Bristol, but who does most of its work in India. And I was the project director for a project we were working there called Wash Basins, which is all about integrated water resource management and how you work with local individuals, farmers, villagers around preserving and benefiting from their groundwater and their water and sanitation systems. And we helped design a digital toolkit and went out and met with a lot of the communities to really co-create a toolkit that is now hosted on mobile phones, because everybody has a mobile phone, and it helps make better decisions about water management within their local catchments. So something that we've been able to help fund and upskill and then leave as a legacy, and it's still being used. So that was around the Global Challenge. And then the six capitals ways of working is a concept that I've come across more recently in the last couple of years that sits very well with my belief that when we do a project, it can be beneficial in so many more ways than perhaps the original brief or the intention. And that if we stop and think carefully, we can impact a project and make it sort of sixfold better. So the six capitals is an interesting one. The six capitals are financial, manufactured, natural, social, human, and intellectual. And when people talk about sustainability, normally we think very much about the natural sustainability, and you might think of biodiversity, but you might not think so much about the intellectual capital. How is this project going to help raise knowledge and awareness? How might it help with financially in the area? How might it help the people of the area? How might it help the society in the area? And by thinking in those six ways, you can open up the discussions around the options. So when you're looking at a project and you've got a variety of options, you're trying to weigh up the benefits of which ones to go ahead with. If you think about the advantages under each of those six capitals, and we've found ways to monetize that, then you're able to compare and contrast the options and make a really informed decision about the best scheme with the biggest impact for the pounds that you're spending. And that's been quite revolutionary in our way of being able to talk with clients and stakeholders and argue for the projects with the biggest positive benefit.
Yeah, and there's something you told me you speak to every single client about. So they'll come to you with a certain project and you'll always look at it in the round.
Yeah.
And with that way of thinking applied.
Yeah, sometimes even if they haven't asked us to, which and the intention is just to provoke that extra, what more could we be doing whilst we're doing this scheme? Mm-hmm. And have you thought about doing this differently?
Right. So we've heard about Greener Grangetown, and I just wondered, I know obviously you've been at AREP for some time, but you have had previous roles and things as well, all of which are really, really interesting. In the years you've worked for AREP and beforehand, what are the standout projects that you have worked on for you?
So yeah, you're right. I've had about, I often joke that I've had 6 or 7 careers within AREP by moving around between countries and types of projects and different positions within project delivery teams. So you're right, I'm now looking after a water team. But prior to that, I spent many years working as a structural engineer in buildings. And so I had the pleasure of my first 2 projects with AREP when I was a fresh graduate were the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden and Tate Modern. So I've got some really stunning buildings on my CV. And then when I went over to California around 2000, I then was working on seismic buildings and how do you design buildings to withstand earthquakes. And there's one there that's a particularly iconic building, the California Academy of Sciences. And the highlight for me was getting to design the pool in which they house the albino alligator and trying to work out how heavy, I still remember trying to work out how heavy the fake trees and rocks in this alligator's pool was and how would I design the floor slab to hold those up. So there's been some high points. But then there's also been some very humble projects. So we've talked about the Greener Grangetown, and there was a scheme that stuck with me as well, where we were designing the flood defences and we met the community we were going to be protecting from flooding. And for anybody who's ever had their home flooded, it is hugely traumatic. And to meet the people who we were directly assisting, that made a big impact on me as well.
Yeah. You've had such a successful and challenging career so far. We've talked about the kind of standout projects. Have there been any standout challenges on the way? And how have you overcome those?
Yeah. So there was
if you're happy to share.
Yeah, happy to share. I might not give all the names for the intro. But there was a project I was involved with about 15 years ago, and it was at the heyday when we were building all sorts of things. If you can think back to 2006, when the world was going full speed ahead and lots of things were being built, and this was a particularly adventurous project that was going to be built in South America with a Spanish developer. And so that's when I was in Madrid a lot, and the developer had a very challenging manner about him and was very, very demanding. And I was the main spokesperson, I was leading it for AREP. So I was often in a room with him and the architect and a few others, but I was the sole representative of AREP. And for the whole year and a half, he only referred to me as the girl. And never learned my name. And we had a series of very tough meetings, which I would try and hold my own in, but I'm not fluent in Spanish. I had to have a translator. And they were very, very challenging meetings. And to the point at which I actually said at one point, I cannot work on this project anymore, because I was being asked to make changes to the scheme that I was not willing to do. He was thumping the table and said, take out these seismic braces. We don't get earthquakes in Panama. And I would be saying, I'm a professional engineer. You do get earthquakes in Panama. I cannot remove the seismic bracing. And it was after one of these exchanges, which turned very rude and insulting, that I actually stepped away from the project. And it's interesting reflecting back now, 15 years on, how would I respond now if I was in a similarly challenging conversation? I'm a lot more confident now. I've had other challenging conversations that I've got through and survived. And I would like to think I would hold my ground, and I would like to think the outcome would be different and I wouldn't walk away and that we would have somehow come to resolution. But it was a time where I found I had hit my limit, and I know I needed to step away. And I hated doing that, actually, because it was like admitting defeat. But I wasn't making any headway. And I came back to Home Office and I said, we need to put somebody else in the room with this guy. I cannot make any headway. And so actually admitting that I wasn't the right person for the role, which is something that's tough to do, to say, this isn't me. This role now needs somebody different, with a different personality match.
Exactly. It's actually a really brave decision to make, because I think I don't know how many people would make that decision and kind of take control of the situation like that.
Mm. Yeah, well, it was starting to have an impact on my health and the well-being of people around me, because I tried to solve it myself at first. I couldn't, and I took it very personally. So yes, I stepped away for a while, and I actually took a leave of absence, just because I was shattered and tired and a bit worn down by this very tough project. But that was a real turning point in my career, to step away and go back to university and do a master's and have that time to think, to reprioritize. And I did a master's in sustainability, and that really helped cement that this was an area I wanted to work in. This was what was important to me. And by stepping away, how did I want to structure my life? How did I want to approach projects and the level of personal commitment to them in a way that was survivable? You know, so you retain some of your own personality as well whilst you're giving your all. Because I do believe in, if you're going to bother doing something, you're going to do it well. And we chatted before about how this has led to my whole idea around having an integrated life. For a while I was trying to have this balance, and I realized that the balance was always something I was then going, oh, am I working or am I living today, and which one am I doing, and you know, questioning myself. And then I read a book by Laura Vanderkam, and she talks about an integrated life. And that's one where you recognize that you are an engineer, and I love being an engineer and I love seeing great projects happen, but I'm also a mum, I'm also a wife, I'm also a sister, I'm a friend, I'm also a runner, and I'm a person who sometimes likes to go off and do things on their own. And all of those things are part of me, and they don't neatly sit into work and life compartments, and sometimes they'll overlap. And that actually an integrated life means that if I want to go for a run on a beautiful morning and I'm going to start work half an hour later, that's fine. Because you know what? I'll easily make up that half an hour later on in the day. And so this freedom to just view my life as an integrated life and not be apologizing for being in the wrong box at the wrong time was incredibly liberating, and is something I keep trying to make sure that's how I'm living, is just this wonderfully integrated life and acknowledging that all of those aspects are part of me.
Absolutely. I love that, because you just don't hear that. You know, people always talk about the work-life balance, and so it's just really refreshing to hear someone's, you know, the concept of an integrated life. It's just closer to reality. That is how it is. It's just your life that you're living.
Exactly.
No, thank you. That's something that stayed with me as well since we first spoke. Finally, something a bit fun to finish. I'm a big fan of books and podcasts, particularly political and parenting podcasts. Are there any podcasts or books that have particularly grabbed you or inspired you that you would recommend to our listeners?
So I'll finish with the details of that, Laura Vanderkam. So I mentioned Laura Vanderkam, and
you
the
did.
Book, the title is I Know How She Does It. So if anybody wants to read about Laura's view around integrated life concepts, she also does some handy little podcasts that are only 5 minutes long and a TED talk. So she's great. I really like the way. And although her title says I Know How She Does It, I've actually recommended that book to many male colleagues as well. This whole concept about an integrated life, that's not gender specific. That is just to do with the busyness and the demands that the world has on us at the moment, which is always multiple. And then there's another one which isn't even officially a management book or a book, but it's called Taming Toddlers. And I was recommended this one when I had a toddler, my first child, and then I read it again with my second child. And but it actually speaks so well to dealing with difficult clients, negotiations, letting people think that a good idea was their idea, and then moving things forward. So there's a lot to learn from Taming Toddlers. And then I think the final one I was going to mention was the Lean In book by Sheryl Sandberg. And this whole concept about acknowledging that there may be disadvantages being female in a male-dominated environment, but making sure that you're present and not using that as an excuse to step back. So making sure you are at the table, you are leaning in. And I sometimes laugh because I even physically do this. I notice that when I go to a meeting, I am quite careful about choosing where am I going to sit around the table, how am I sitting, how am I framing my voice and getting my point across and making sure I'm present in the room.
Thank you. And thank you so much for meeting with us today and taking part in this podcast series. It's been brilliant speaking to you and hearing all about your career and your experiences and your refreshing outlook on life and the approach, particularly to that. The so-called work-life balance and this concept of an integrated life. So thank you so much. It's been really lovely speaking to you.
Likewise, pleasure. It's nice to sometimes stop and reminisce. So thank you for the opportunity to do that.